The Triathlon Show 363. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm Ross Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Professor Øyvind Sandbakk. Øyvind works at the Center for Elite Sports Research at the Norwegian University for Science and Technology, and the research he has conducted over the years covers vast areas and sports. But what we'll discuss mostly today is going a bit deeper into a recent review paper that Øyvind and his team conducted on the training characteristics of world-class distance runners. So that will be our main topic for today. But before we get into that, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that create sports nutrition products, including fueling and hydration products, and they help you use them effectively through a range of free tools, services, and content. The Fuel and Hydration Planner on their website is a one-stop shop for figuring out an effective race hydration and fueling strategy for you. It's free and super easy to use. It only takes a couple of minutes to answer a handful of questions, and then you get a detailed, simple, and effective race plan. They also offer free video consultations. As a listener of the podcast, you can get 15% off your order of their range of electrolyte and carbohydrate products by using the code TTS22 at checkout on precisionfuelandhydration.com. And thank you to Senate. The Senate Indoor Swim Trainer is a unique dryland swim trainer that allows you to improve technique, power, and swim training consistency. It is a perfect tool to complement your pool and open water swimming, as it allows you to do very specific power and technique work, including working on your catch and your core activation, and it makes it easier to stay consistent even when you can't go to the pool. You can even use it to do activation work before a pool or open water swim, or to do swim, bike, brick workouts more easily. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days, so if you don't love it, just send it back. And you can get a special TTS bundle including the swim bench and a bunch of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on senateswimtrainer.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Professor Øyvind Sandbakk. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Øyvind. How are you doing?
Thank you. I am really, really pleasure to speak to you. So, to talk about some of my favorite areas, that is training.
Yeah, and for the listeners that don't know you, of course, you have done a lot of research and you have a lot of papers out there. But can you start by giving, in your own words, describe your background within endurance sports and a little bit more about what you're doing now and what you have been up to in the last decades and years in endurance sports?
Yeah, I grew up in Norway as a cross country skier from a quite young age, and I also did quite some running, athletics. And then I kind of decided to focus on cross-country skiing, and I really pursued my skiing career until I realized that I will not attend any world championships. I was a few times allowed to participate in the World Cup on the national group in Norway, which is not so bad, but to take the next step was difficult. So then I was also studying sports science and exercise physiology, so I was allowed to coach a few good athletes, also join the national team and be kind of a helping coach there, and gradually I started to work for Olympiatoppen, Norwegian Top Sports Center, and in collaboration between the university in Trondheim, NTNU, and Olympiatoppen, I started on my PhD. That was also on sprint cross-country skiing, and where we tried to look at the demands there and also how can you train to become good sprint skiers. So that's what I've done. After that, combining research, working with athletes and coaches. So I was kind of working in Olympiatoppen for 13 years, some years ahead of research and development there, and at the same time did my research at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. So now I'm work as a professor at NTNU and the director of the Center for Elite Sports Research, which is my main thing. And then I have a cool position, a smaller one, just at the School of Sports Science at the Arctic University of Norway, where we do this Fendura project, the female endurance athletes, where we put some extra emphasis on that. So, yeah, so I've been allowed to work in elite sports and research for at least the last 15, 20 years.
Yeah, excellent. And what would you say in the last few years, maybe, do you have any areas that you have been doing the most? What are the areas of research you have been focusing on the most?
I did a lot on cross-country skiing in the beginning. And then very often we looked into the demands of the sport, kind of what are really the demands of sprint cross-country skiing that I started with. And then we looked at distance cross-country skiing. We look now a lot on the mass starts. Then I had PhD students working on sex differences. There was actually, and then we looked more into to women, not only on men. That was mostly researched on before. So we started a pathway to look into women as well, their characteristics. And then, of course, I tried to use the same framework on other sports. So we had very nice projects on Nordic Combined, on biathlon. We looked into cycling. We started now a bit on triathlon. And always with the same kind of way of thinking, looking into the demands of the sport and how you can meet those demands with optimizing the training. So it's a mix from descriptive studies, describing the demands or what the best athletes are training, to intervention studies where we look more into the effects of different types of training per se. And also some studies where we look more into kind of mechanisms and molecular mechanisms associated with different types of training. So I've been very lucky to have many good PhD students and postdocs and been collaborating with many, many good professors. So that's been a journey that I'm really been really lucky to be on board.
Yeah, that's something that is very noticeable when reading just research within endurance sports in general, that I always am surprised by just how frequently there are really excellent papers coming out of Norway in general and quite often from your lab at NTNU. But yeah, you're clearly doing some great work there. We will be quite focused in this interview because there's obviously a lot we could talk about, but we will talk about a relatively newly published study that you were involved with the training characteristics of world-class distance runners. So as you said, one of those descriptive studies. So can you introduce this research? What was the background behind setting out to do this kind of review?
Yeah, first I want to acknowledge Thomas Haugen, who took the initiative for this study. And we did several studies together. And then he teamed up with Espen Tønnesen and Steven Saylor. So we were kind of a group of four. We had previously looked at sprint running, actually, and used the same type of framework there. Then we looked into middle distance, and then we ended up this trilogy with long distance running. So it was basically the fact that, in our view, the best coaches and the best athletes are very often ahead of science. So we thought that, okay, what the literature is lacking is actually trying to grasp what are really the best athletes doing and their coaches, what are their philosophies around this, and then trying to provide an overview of kind of existing literature on it, but also kind of not kind of published scientific literature that can help us to maybe grasp some new ideas, generate some new hypotheses, and also go a bit ahead what has previously been published.
So what kind of sources are we talking about there when you say go beyond the literature?
No, of course we used PubMed and Google Scholar and looked into kind of the literature, of course, to get an overview of what is there already. And thereafter, we looked more at what we called results-proven practice. That was kind of non-scientific, but publicly available English training information. So that's from podium athletes and international coaches, and also those winning the world marathon majors. So that's from websites like you probably heard of Runners Universe, Sweet Elite, Running Science, Let's Run, Runners Tribe, these type of. And then download them, and then try to grasp kind of the main content and systematize that, and try to see, because of course it's a mix and art of science what the best athletes and coaches are doing, but we try to grasp kind of the main factors that we saw were common among good distance runners and marathon runners. So that was a, and then of course we looked into long distance running books and some did some Google search as well, trying to really grasp what is out there of information that we can try to interpret as good as possible.
I think here it's important to highlight for listeners that are maybe not as familiar with how the scientific research method is normally done, is that what you did is quite unique, because usually a review like this would focus on anything that has been published and peer-reviewed before, but not sources that are outside of the scientific literature. So obviously that has advantages in that it gives you a lot more information and data to work with, and perhaps also in some cases it can be a bit more, maybe not as systematic, but maybe it can be more detailed in some ways when you see a training log. So can you explain a bit more what you think are the strengths and the limitations about this method of doing a review?
Yeah, of course, we call this kind of results-proven practice, and we have a view that kind of unique athletes and coaches are often ahead of what has been published. And also, it's very difficult to do research on these athletes because they found a formula that apparently worked for them, and they don't want to change that, so you can't go in and intervene. And this is of course something that we can learn from, and at least see what seems to work across athletes who succeed. But on the other hand, you have kind of a confirmation bias, because maybe those who don't succeed do pretty much the same. So that's something you need to be very aware of while doing this type of research. So you don't kind of go into your echo chamber and without being a bit critical towards the data that you collect. So we try to be reasonable in our interpretations. But then, of course, this is not peer-reviewed. It's training logs or even secondary sources. There's a male dominance. It's not so many women in our material, unfortunately. There are a few training groups that have been very open about their training. Other groups are more locked, so you kind of just need to be aware that it might be biased by a few groups. And of course, they use different types of intensity zones and terminologies that we really tried to, at least where we conclude, where we try to put it into the same framework in our way of interpreting it. So, yeah, and then it's kind of, there might be a kind of a prescription execution difference that is not taken into account, because it's not the training program that is important, but what you actually did and how you responded to training. And that, of course, we have no analysis of it. We have mainly the training programs or the training logs. And then, of course, we don't know. We have a history of doping in long distance running and marathon. Only the few last weeks we saw a lot of cases coming out. So, although we excluded those who were taking for doping, we that is basically might be a limitation in our material.
Yeah, and final question before we get into some of your findings, but can you just give some examples of well-known names of runners that would be that you had included in your data set?
Yeah, I can just start on the top there. We have types like Saeed Awita, who had many Olympic Olympic gold and also world records. We have Enisa Bekele, for example, Joshua Cheptegei, Steven Cherono, Haile Gebrselassie, Eliud Kipchoge, of course, who is a very famous good one, maybe the GOAT, as they call him. Then we have women like Ingrid Kristiansen, that was in the 80s, had world records from 3,000 to marathon. So these are typical examples of the athletes that we have information about. And then we have some famous coaches, of course, like from Bill Bowerman and Jack Daniels to more recent coaches such as Renato Canova and Joe Wiggill and these guys. So it's I think it's there are lots of coaches. I think we have 16 coaches and 59 world leading athletes. So that's what we included in total.
Yeah, those are good names to have there. So let's get into some of your findings. And well, you investigated a lot of things. Just to give an overview here for the listeners, you looked at training periodization, competition scheduling, training volume, workouts, training density distribution, and strength training, those tapering, altitude, and so on. So we'll just try to touch on a few of those, or the most important ones. So maybe we can start with periodization, training periodization, and competition scheduling. So what did you find in those areas?
Of course, you have, if we talk very simplified, you have a preparation period where you try to build up capacities. And then, of course, that's the period where athletes are trying to maintain capacities that are good enough and further develop those you want to improve. Then you often have a kind of more a specific period towards the competition season where going from the general preparation period with very often high volume to build kind of what they call the aerobic foundation to kind of the specific preparation period where the focus is gradually shifting towards a higher volume of race pace intensity. And then, of course, you come into the competition period, and then after the competition period, most athletes have 1 to 4 weeks kind of with less training or some even no training for a while to recover after the competition period. And I think it's kind of what we see in track runners is kind of a high volume in total. It's all who have succeeded, they are running a lot with around 80% of that volume being at what we call low intensity. They still run fast because they're so good, but it's at low metabolic intensity. And then a quite high volume of kind of sub-threshold endurance training, which is kind of typical. And then transitioning towards a kind of a period with more race-based training. Although we see they are careful not to overuse it or introduce it too early, and they also maintain the sub-threshold endurance training throughout kind of the competition period. I think it's quite interesting because you see kind of that you just shift the focus on what capacities do you want to maintain. It's also so that during the preparation period, you also some of them they are involved in a few competitions, so they have some high intensity work, not often, but it's kind of there is a maintenance of it. And also when you come to the competition period, you maintain kind of the volume quite well, you maintain the sub threshold focus. So it's not kind of a total change as sometimes is seen in more general periodization literature, but it is gradual shift And I think you just change the factors that you put emphasis on to develop, but all the factors you try to maintain those capacities. And I think that's an important thing to look at. So there's not a rapid change. There is gradual changes and not extreme changes. But I think that's common for all athletes, although there are individual differences. So then in marathon runners, there is a different pattern, I would say, than in track runners. So they, you could say that they might introduce a little bit more focus on kind of, for a marathon runner, higher speeds early in the cycle, and then prioritize more race-specific long workouts towards the marathons. So it's while track runners are kind of having more the sub-threshold early and then have more at higher intensity towards their competition, marathoners, they compete at sub-threshold intensities. So you kind of, especially for marathon runners who need more speed, of course, they need to focus on that earlier in the training cycles and don't then go with the higher speed potential towards the more marathon-specific workouts and have that put that as the main focus of the training week. So I think, but of course, in a marathon runner, if you come from track running with high speed capacity, you might kind of have a different way of periodizing or training in the preparation period than someone who has done marathon for 10 years.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Just a couple of follow-up questions. When we talk about sub-threshold running in this context, can you maybe give some examples of what some workouts might look like in that? We're talking about training in the heavy intensity domain when we're talking sub-threshold training in this context, right?
Yeah. You can say it can be done different ways. Of course, you have, if you look at the different types of methods, it's very often done as intervals, but it can also, then is very often long intervals with relatively short breaks. So you can kind of accumulate quite long total distance during those sessions. But of course, you can also do this as progressive long runs, where you kind of increase the speed and then you come up to that pace the last part of the session. Kind of a fartlek is also another method, it can be in varying terrain over 30 to 60 minutes, or you kind of have a little bit unsystematic. Or systematic. I think you see that in Kenya, they have quite a systematic fartlek. So it's different ways of doing these type of trainings. We have a table in our paper where we try to show the different tools that athletes use. And I think also different athletes with different physiological profiles might use different tools, because depending on what they want to target or what they need to target to take the next step.
The paper is open access, so we'll have a link, of course, in the show notes, so listeners can go and have a look at the table to see some specifics. One other question on we were talking about the periodization, but we were mentioning the types of workouts done, so this is already going into what the workouts look like, but can you comment on whether these runners, world-class runners, typically go very hard in their workouts, or if that depends a bit on the period? Like in the base training, they're not really close to their max capacity, but then maybe in the race preparation, they do a few workouts that are basically at max capacity. What does that look like?
I would say that how it looks like from what we've seen is that it's very seldom all out. It's controlled work, and where they train so many hours and kilometers per week that they do, it's kind of, you need to think a bit like a chess player, because if you kind of go all out on one session, it has consequences for the upcoming 2, 3, 4 sessions. So if you kind of just keep it a controlled intensity, depending on, of course, what the aim is with the session, I think then it seems like, especially during the preparation period, that they're able to accumulate more work that is close enough to being race specific, and the total kind of the total volume of training. So you don't see that they are training kind of at max effort very often. And I think that has to do with that gives them the possibility to accumulate this work and then also avoid kind of setbacks and injuries and be in control of the training. So in running, I think kind of intensity steering is important, and always having control over the total accumulation of load that you put on an athlete.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. And what about the competition scheduling? So how many races do these athletes typically do, the track runners and the marathon runners, and when would they do races?
Yeah, it's of course, it depends a bit, because some do this double periodization, they have the indoor or the cross-country period, and then kind of the track, outdoor track running period. Or some just focus on the summer season among the distance runners. But we found an average of 9 competitions, but it's quite a big standard deviation. So some they use probably competitions also as part of their training to build up. And then, but there are not so many major and important competitions compared to some other sports I looked into. It's very seldom that a cross-country skier does less than 30 competitions a year. So, but it also has to do with the load of doing these running competitions. It's very high mechanical load and also different culture of how much you compete. Among the marathoners, it's very often kind of you have the spring and you have the autumn marathon. And it's very, very seldom that you see more than 2 marathons a year, and then maybe 1 or 2 half marathons, and then kind of shorter distances. So in total, we found an average of 6 competitions, also with a decent standard deviation. So.
Yeah, and in terms of training volume, if we dive a bit deeper into that, what are the typical training volumes that you found?
Yeah, if you look at kind of distance runners in kind of the preparation period, we found, yeah, I would say around 130 to 190 is what we wrote. And then we wrote...
That's kilometers per week.
Yeah. And then with a little bit more for the marathon, maybe 30 kilometers more, so 160 to 220. But of course, you see periods or single weeks or some athletes that are extreme. There are marathoners with up to 250 plus, and also track runners who do over 200. But I think this is kind of what the average is if you look into the entire period we found these kilometers. But then you come back again. You have some who do quite a lot of alternative training. Some are kind of having very weak, a couple of weekly strength training sessions. Some use alternative modes because they don't want to get injured. And then it also depends on what type of terrain you're running in. If you only run kind of flat, or if you also have a little bit more of the hilly terrain that some athletes are choosing in the surface. So it's not only about the kilometers, it's also about what you add on in addition to the specific kilometers and what surface you run on and what terrain you run on. So, but it's quite a lot of kilometers, and that's not very surprising, I would assume.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things to have as a runner is probably the ability to not get injured, and there are of course multiple factors that go into that, like mechanics and and recovery, of course, but yeah, some things that you can impact, but some things that are maybe a little bit more difficult to impact and just kind of you're almost born with them, or at least they are somewhat innate. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. And I also look a bit on the triathletes and have a good dialogue with the coaches of Norwegian triathlon. And of course, in this type of sports, and where you have either you can use different modes, or you have modes where you kind of don't have so high mechanical loading, you can kind of endure many more hours, maybe twice as many hours per week than a runner, because you are limited by the mechanical loading, especially when running on hard surface. So that's what we see also on the, of course, here in Norway, we have some runners who are doing some skiing in the winter because they don't want to get injured. And of course, then they can accumulate much more hours than they could have done in their running. So, So injury.
Other than skiing, what do you see in runners over the world? What are their favored cross training modes for those runners that do some form of cross training? Cycling or elliptico is something that we have seen some athletes famously use. What did you see were the most common ones?
Yeah, I think, of course, those who are injured, a few of them running in water. This is a little bit outside what we saw and looked at here, but if, of course, when they are injured, running in water is one method that is typically used. And of course, you have these, what do you call it, elliptic machines that are, many say it's very boring, but you just need to do the work. I think in the countries where you have snow, it's kind of classical cross-country skiing can be a nice way that we see that some use. And you see less of cycling, but I know in Sweden, for example, now there is a runner. I can't remember his name. I'm really sorry. I know you're Swedish, but he's
actually Swedish speaking Finn. But
well, he was I think he was quite a lot in the media in Sweden now. But he talked a lot to the speed skater Van der Poel, and he started to do a lot of cycling as kind of to be able to do more training. And he had a very positive performance developing this year. So you also see some who are cycling and might get an effect of that. But this is something we don't know from research. It's kind of the effect. Of course, you know, you stimulate your central parts of the aerobic system, but kind of how similar it has to be to have an impact on actually running performance, we don't know. You need to run a lot. That is what we know. But what do you do in addition? What tools you use in addition? There might be individuals who has kind of limitations in their kind of aerobic central system can get an extra effect from doing additional stuff that triggers that. But those who are mainly resisted by kind of the running economy, they need to run more. So it might also be individual differences there.
Of course. What did you find? Did the training volume change a lot across the periodization of the season, or was it fairly steady throughout the year?
Of course, when it's important competitions, you will need to kind of reduce volume a bit towards the competitions. But I would say they keep up training surprisingly well throughout the year. But there are different traditions, for example, in this transition period where they should recover after the competition period. You have some athletes who at least say that they take four weeks totally off. and other athletes who say they take 1 or 2 weeks and then still they run 100 kilometers per week. So there are different traditions there. So it's very hard to say what is right. It's probably a mental recovery that is important as well. So in kind of how much people offload during this transition period is probably where we see the largest differences. There are different needs.
But no huge difference between the general preparation and the specific preparation when you're before tapering. So if you're 16 or let's say 12 weeks out or 5 weeks out from the race, maybe it's, did you see a difference there, or was that very similar because you're still not tapering for the race, but you are getting close?
You're quite close to the race before you really see the tapering. I think it's very often the last 7 to 10 days where you kind of see that. In championships, that's also the typical time where you come to the competition venue. So compared to the literature, it's kind of, they maintain volume a little bit longer normally. But it also depends a bit on how you set up the competition schedule. Those who are competing closer to the championships, for example, they of course need to reduce volume a bit because you need to have a total balance that is good. Those who prioritize training, they can maintain volume and even have a good training camp where they increase volume a bit. And then the last 7 to 10 days is tapering and reducing volume a bit. I think for the marathoners, you have also quite a few examples where people actually increase load until this last couple of weeks where you reduce volume. So that's, I think there is kind of, I would say, they deviate a little bit from what has shown in meta-analysis and stuff in research. So that's interesting to see what the best.
When it comes to the taper specifically, it seems a little bit shorter than what we've found. But I was actually having this discussion with somebody earlier today about tapering, and at least I haven't seen a lot of taper research recently. It seems like a lot of it was done, I don't know, a decade ago, and there are some meta-analysis 5-7 years ago, but there's not that many studies coming out recently, I don't think, about tapering. So maybe it's a little bit behind what the best athletes are doing simply.
I think so. And I think it's kind of, I think, and also I think that's something I have thought about a lot lately is kind of what is actually tapering. Instead of thinking about what should you do, you should have 2 weeks like this and 1 week like that. And it's kind of, I think more and more that you just need to remember what are the main kind of reason behind a good taper. And that is that your race specific capacities are as good as possible. You need to be as good trained as possible, specific for the distance that you want to compete in. And then you need to be able to utilize that capacity. So it's kind of, you need to train up and optimize your capacities for that given distance. And then you need sufficient time to recover mentally, but also physically. And then you need to mobilize. So it's kind of, it's three phases for me. You have kind of course, what you did throughout the entire year. And that, of course, when the most important competitions are approaching, you are at your highest level. You have never been so good trained as when you're approaching a competition. Then you need to make sure that you are mentally and physically recovered. And in the end, you need to mobilize both mentally and physically towards the competitions. Because if you only recover, you probably will kind of lose tension. And you need somehow to mobilize the body again. And then this is kind of defining that balance. It's you really need to look very carefully into what the situation is for the athletes. So what worked one season might not be optimal the next season because there might have been some kind of a cold that you catched, the athlete catched, or it might be that for some reason they didn't respond so well to the preparation, the training period approaching the championships, or that there was a small injury, or that maybe there was a competition that you needed to participate in that wasn't the year before. And all that would influence how many days do you need for this tapering and how much do you need to offload And then again, is to find the individual patterns on how to mobilize the body to be really sharp when the competitions are there. So that's kind of my philosophy on it. And not that kind of there is kind of a very static way of doing it.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Like you have to think about it from what you want to achieve and then design the taper accordingly rather than, I think it's the same with, like, you have seen it a bit in training intensity distribution recently, that sometimes people try to fit the training intensity distribution to their training rather than planning the training. And then if the training is planned well, then the training intensity distribution takes care of itself. Yeah. So I think it's probably a little bit of the same situation with the taper. But that being said, just to understand the characteristics of these elite athletes better, when they get to those 7 to 10 days where you said that they start tapering, how does the volume change and the training characteristics change in that period?
No, it's the typical what you see, of course, is that they reduce most of them maintain kind of their training frequency quite well, because I think it's both about maintaining kind of your daily rhythm, so you don't lose the daily rhythm. So kind of try to maintain a decent number of, maybe you reduce a little bit, but frequency of sessions are quite well maintained. You shorten the sessions a bit to kind of have less load, and then maintain intensity up. Or sometimes you even have a few sessions that are even at higher speeds, but very often smart designs of the session, so you can train at race pace or kind of maybe some sessions a little bit above. And I think that's the typical way of doing it in this offloading. And if you train 180 kilometers per week, you kind of typically you go down to 110, 120, for example, in the last week before mobilizing towards these competitions. But it's,
And when they are maintaining frequency, we didn't talk about that yet. What is a typical frequency of runs that these athletes do in a week? Is it 11, 12, 13, 14 runs?
Yeah. There are, of course, some they have kind of like to have one resting day, and then it normally ends up with 11 or 12 sessions, very often 12 if you have one resting day. Others, they have two resting sessions. So maybe I would say an average of 12 sessions. Of course, you have some athletes who sometimes do their morning sessions and do three sessions a day some days. But kind of the normal pattern is two sessions a day and then a resting day every week or every second week for some, or you put in resting sessions couple of times a week. It's not like in cycling that you do one session a day that is very long. You split it up, both because the running competitions, marathon is quite long, so then you often have these long runs with only one session a day, once or twice a week. But for distance runners, the competitions are so, let's say, short that you don't need too many of these very long runs. And then you'd rather split it up in shorter runs.
Yeah, absolutely. Specificity is always really important. And I mentioned training intensity distribution, and you talked earlier about 80% being low intensity. What about the moderate and high intensity? How does that split? And I imagine that maybe there are some differences in periodization and between the track versus marathon runner. So can you go into training intensity distribution a little bit?
Yeah, it's if you look at kind of, I would say that most, and this is not all, but very often we see kind of three, I would say, heavy days during the week, and these are kind of for the distance runners, very often the moderate or high intensity sessions. It's kind of more threshold or sub-threshold sessions, or the few more high intensity sessions that they have. I think more, we haven't seen too much of it in this review. It, of course, it's been there since the 1960s, so it's nothing new to have these kind of double thresholds or kind of have two moderate or hard sessions per day, like the Ingebrigtsen, for example, has been introducing in Scandinavia. That's also seen in many track runners throughout history. But it's not kind of the pattern that we found. But we found three heavy days per week in many athletes, and then some a little bit easier days in between. And I would say the sub-threshold sessions are very the most common during the preparation period. And then, of course, there is a gradual shift to adding more of higher intensity sessions. But of course, for 5,000 meter runners, or even those who are also running some 3,000, 1,500 meter, they organize this very smart, because it's kind of like, you can say that if you do 25 times 400 meters with 30 second breaks, and you run at 5,000 meter speed, you accumulate so much race specific kind of time without accumulating metabolic fatigue. So you can kind of call it metabolically some kind of, many call it a threshold session, but speed wise, it's much closer to a more higher intensity session. So it's one thing is kind of the speed that you train at, and the other thing is kind of the metabolic accumulation of fatigue that you want to reduce. Then, of course, 10,000 meter runners and those a little bit higher would probably have most of their kind of sub-threshold, metabolic sub-threshold sessions as a little bit longer intervals and at a little bit lower speed than what we would see in those who are drifting at the lower part of long distance running. So, but there is this gradual shift in intensity, and there are quite large differences between athletes here, because we said, let's say 80% of the distance is low intensity, and then you have 5 to 15% at what we sub threshold moderate intensity, and 5 to 15% at higher intensities. Of course, these who are up at 15 high intensity are kind of outliers, and also the same for sub-threshold. So there are quite large ranges there, but it is around 20% of the volume is what we see is in these zones for the distance runners. But then for marathoners, I would say that the pattern is a little bit different, because they build up the week much more around these long marathon-specific sessions, especially when approaching the last 10 to 15 weeks before an important marathon. And then they, of course, also have these normal intervals or fartlek sessions once or twice a week in addition to that one. They build their week more around these marathon-specific sessions when it's approaching the competitions. So I think I think that sums up. It's very broad and general, but it is kind of that there are individual pathways on this and individual preferences.
Yeah. I think that's a good answer, and it kind of reflects what we just talked about, that it's more about finding the pattern of training that works, and then the intensity distribution itself, the numbers, that's a consequence, that's not the goal.
Yeah, and it's kind of what you also see if you look historically on it. It's, for example, how fast are your low intensity sessions, because you have kind of some athletes that are running quite fast on their low intensity. They're kind of in the higher part of the low intensity sessions quite commonly. while others are kind of a little bit more polarized there. They are lower at the low intensity sessions, and maybe then have the capacity to have a little bit more of the training at these higher intensities. So it's always about the total of your training. So that's where kind of the small individual differences are, and maybe that's also differences that are related to that physiological profile, because you have a given background. If you come from marathon or if you come from 1500 meter, it's quite a, and you're running a 10,000 meter, it's kind of, you have very different training backgrounds and you have very different physiological profiles, and then you probably need to set up the training differently for those types of athletes. It's not that the big patterns are the same, but kind of the types of sessions and the small differences in training intensity distributions would probably reflect that they have a different background and profiles.
Yeah. One more question about the specific sessions. So I'm curious about the fastest sessions that the athletes do. So for example, if we have a track runner who focuses on 5 and 10,000 meters, is it common for them to do sessions that are faster than their 5K race pace, or is that not very common at all, and the fastest they run would be around more or less 5K race pace? And for the marathoners, you mentioned that they might do more their fast running earlier in the season, but again, what would the speed of that their fast running be? Would it be around 5K race pace, even though that's not their focus, or do some runners do a lot of work that is quite a lot faster than that kind of speed?
I would say that it depends on where you are in the training year. If you look at the preparation period, it's quite a lot of these sub threshold training as we talked about, and some sessions. For example, you have hill running, for example. They don't run at higher speeds, but I think that the work that they do are at a pretty high maybe 5,000 meter or even faster loads, you can say. So there are kind of components in the training that is also triggering kind of an over speed. And I know that they do these strides, or they have some athletes are in this period running with spikes, doing 100 meters or 200 meters. They don't call it high intensity sessions, but they just do it to be up in kind of over speeds and to kind of prevent injuries, because if you don't run at these high speeds and even put on the spikes, I think it's for too long time, it might be a too rapid introduction again when you start doing more specific sessions. So just have that continuity in that without having a high load of it is one method. Other athletes seems to do sprints and some hill sprints, just short 10 seconds regularly to both for the muscles to mobilize, but also to, I think, trigger this overspeed. So it's so you maintain that. It's very seldom that you get long distance runner to become much faster, but you can maintain speed. And I think it might also play a role for economy of running, that you also see in a bit with plyometric training and strength training, that if you have limitations there, it might help your running economy to increase your strength or your power somehow. So I think also to run it's something with running in overspeed that is, you can't avoid that for too long, but I don't think you need too much input of it. But then when you enter the kind of specific training periods before the competitions or in the competition period, there are clear, much more of the athletes are having intervals where they are running at over speed, a little bit faster than what they compete at. But of course, then you not so the load is not too high. You need to kind of have longer breaks, shorter intervals, and it has of course consequences for the other types of training. So maybe the low intensity sessions that comes afterwards will be a little bit slower then, so the total balance is there.
Yeah. And how common is strength training and different types of strength and conditioning, including also plyometric training? How common is that?
It's large differences, and also large differences what they do. It's the same with kind of, the Kenyan athletes, they have their flexibility programs, so their gym training that they do, which is part of their culture. If that makes them better or not, we don't know, but it's at least they do it. And then you have different regimes, but we should keep in mind that strength and kind of sprint and explosiveness training is a tool for some athletes to have an overcapacity of strength and power that might make you more economically, so you can actually, it costs less to work so maximally when you have overcapacity, or make you more fatigue resistant. So when you get fatigued, you have a little bit higher kind of roof of your strength and power. When kind of that is going down and you get more and more fatigued, it might help you to be a bit more fatigue resistant. That's the theory. So that is one element, but then it needs to be specific for running. And then it depends a bit on what the athlete lacks. If they lack strength, of course, that will be a focus. If they lack power, the ability to produce force rapidly, then that will be in focus. So you need to look at kind of what exercises you choose in order to develop that for the individual athlete. So it's very individual and specific, I think, what is needed. And then it's, of course, culture dependent. And you don't really know if they do this because of their part of the culture or if it makes them better. But I think what it should be is that you need to individualize it. And then, of course, you have strength training to avoid injuries. And that's kind of something that is much more discussed. There is coming more and more research, more on team sports than in running, and more in sprint running than in long distance running. But there are exercises that we know can be reduce injury risks. And of course, you have
what exercises would that be, for example?
It's a big discussion. I think. It's not my main expertise, and we didn't cover it that much in this review, but it's quite specific exercises towards kind of the running pattern, and towards kind of, I think you need to look at the individual athlete, what are the risks for this athlete to get injured, and then strengthen those so you kind of have a buffer in strength. Yeah. When you then increase volume, I think there are some reviews out there on specific exercises that could be used by distance runners. So that you don't have, of course, you have sit-ups and back exercises and these core exercises. That is a big discussion. Some use it a lot, but you don't have much. You don't have much science to support it. So I think it's more these exercises that are somehow mimicking parts of the running movement that we have proof of.
Yeah. What about altitude training? That's another topic that you brought up in the review. How is that used?
Many of the best athletes are living at altitude, long parts of the year. Especially African runners, but also some European. Others are using it systematically, kind of both as part of their periodization of training, but also to kind of 3 to 4 week camps at 2,000 meters around. That's kind of the common altitude. And then, of course, you have some examples that has not used it systematically. But I would say that in running, there is a big tradition for it. Then, of course, if you look into the literature and science, which this is a very difficult area to do research on, it's not easy, and especially not when you talk about 1% differences and very small effects. So I would be very careful on concluding. But, of course, there is not a very strong scientific evidence on the effect of altitude training per se. But then, of course, you have some who look at the randomized controlled designs that are done. There are not many that didn't show any big effects. And then you have others who say that, of course, you don't get effect if you don't kind of optimize nutritional factors, training factors, you periodize it into the training program, etc. Then you have also say it's the training camp effect, kind of being at these nice places to train gives a good effect in itself. You can run, for runners, you can run with less mechanical loading, because it's kind of the oxygen pressure is lower, so you get the metabolic loading at a lower speed, so you can train more probably without having too high mechanical loading. And you get a very good kind of periodization of the training. So it's kind of the ultimate effect of this is a big scientific discussion. But what we at least see in our review is that it's used by most good distance runners currently.
And those that don't live at altitude, but they go on camp, what is the minimum duration that they would normally use for those camps?
Yeah, three to four weeks. And I would probably say that there might be some discussions if 2 or 3 weeks are also effective, but I think in runners, we see that they are often there for longer times. And it's very interesting because I think if they didn't feel they got a good effect of it, then I assume they would not have done it. So this is, and many, if they measure kind of hemoglobin mass before and after, you see at least some groups who seems to get quite good effects of it. But then you don't have a control group in these top athletes, so you can't really say kind of what is cause and effect. But personally, I think that you can get some effects on the blood, especially on those who are really responding well to it and did their training in a good way. And then I think the effect of reduced mechanical loading can be positive for runners in this period. And of course, the training, you should utilize the training camp effect. So I have a much, much bigger belief than in proper altitude training than in training in lowland, sleeping in an altitude tent. So I think I would recommend people to go up and enjoy the nature and train outdoors and utilize all those effects depending on if you choose to do altitude training.
Yeah, that is a very good point, that if we don't really know exactly where the effect is coming from, then the altitude tent really puts all your eggs in that one basket of spending time in the hypoxic environment. Whereas, the actual effect might be a mixture of different factors, including the nature, the training camp effect, being there with training partners, and so on. So great point. And other than these things that we discussed so far regarding training characteristics, are there any other characteristics that you would like to point out that we haven't discussed yet that you think are important from this review?
You can say that I think the role of the quality of training is important, and also kind of how you puzzle together your training program. So kind of each of the sessions are good, and one session is interacting with the upcoming one, so that you get kind of many good sessions with high quality throughout kind of the training week. I think looking into micro periodization on kind of how do you puzzle together these sessions so they can interact with each other, and that each of them are good and at high quality, and that the accumulated effect of them are interacting. I think that's kind of that's the art of it, and where the good coaches are really kind of working together with athletes to find kind of the optimized program for each athlete. And what I see is that's one project that we're currently working on. We have now interviewed and looked into data from the most successful coaches in across endurance sports in Norway, in the same group as on this research, and we see kind of how the importance of kind of how the coach and athletes is interacting in order to learn. It's not just giving the athlete a training program; it's these daily kind of adjustments and taking the right decisions at the right time. I think we shouldn't forget the art when we art of coaching or and daily adjustments when we talk about training. That's really, really important. And the learning, and make it a learning process. I think learn how to do good sessions. We talk so much about intensity and lactate and all these things, but it's kind of work systematically, build your database, learn from each sessions. So if this is a gradual learning process where you kind of you build up the database and you know how you should start the sessions, you know how you should respond, that provides you the insurance systems to do good sessions and to stop when you should stop, because you then see this is not good enough, this doesn't make me better, and then you I think that's kind of making this as a learning process is basically what will drive development over time. That's what we see across sports in good coaches and athletes.
So we had a little bit of a technical glitch, but we're back. The next question, if we take a summary of this research and our discussion so far today, what are the main things that you would like the listeners to take away from the information that we have discussed here?
I think, of course, a high running volume at relatively low intensity is, of course, what we see among all distance and marathon runners, which is combined with quite a lot of running at kind of sub-threshold in the preparation period as a foundation. And then there is a gradually shift in more race-specific training. And then that is what will distinguish also a marathon runner from a track runner, which is a more focused training around the marathon-specific long runs for a marathon, and more sessions at getting closer and closer to race speed for track runners, which brings higher intensities. But still, it's not... We need to remember it's not kind of it's a gradual shift there, and it's always maintaining the foundations in training throughout the entire year. So it's, I think that's, and then have continuity, avoid setbacks and injuries. And I think puzzling together the training program so you can get high quality of each session, and at the same time, the ability to accumulate high training loads, both at speeds that are at close to race speed or sub-threshold, but also the total volume. So I think that would be the key.
Yeah, no, good summary. And is there anything that could you give any advice to amateur runners what are the things that you think amateur runners would maybe need to improve the most, like common mistakes that you see amateur runners do and how they could maybe do things more effectively?
Yeah, I think I would, as an amateur, focus on learning how to do a good session. Build up volume progressively to avoid injury. And then have kind of find out, gradually learn how to build up the volume so you actually get effect on the training. Because I think that's what many people miss. They kind of, they think that training more, training harder makes you better, but you need kind of to learn how to do good sessions so that you are motivated and able to train well the day after again and the day after. And then you can gradually progress your volume while still improving the quality of your training sessions. And then having a decent intensity control is important in running, I think. And then, of course, I think as an amateur, you just need to adapt training to your life. It's kind of like your life philosophy and your training philosophy must be aligned. Because in the end, it's the effect of training that counts. The adaptations that you get out of it, and then you need to be focused on that.
Yeah. The typical example would be if you sleep 5 hours a night, you're unlikely to adapt to the training. Some general questions. What would you tell your 20-year-old self as an athlete, as a cross-country skier, if you could go back in time?
Then I would say, listen to your body. It tells you the truth. And do what is right for you today. Don't look at the others. Don't follow them. Do what is right for you today and trust it. In the end, that will make the best effect of the training. It's not so important to win the training, but it's important to do what is right for you and get the effect of it. And I think check that you get the effect that you should and do honest evaluations around it. So you gradually adapt your training to get the effect. It's not the aim to get as many hours high volume as possible or as many high intensity sessions as possible, but focus on getting the effect. And then in the end, I think we'll also tolerate more and more of these tough sessions.
How would you check that? Would you use lab testing or field testing or competitions?
Good combination. I think you have the possibility to have standardized training sessions, testing in the lab, of course, now and then. But I think more what you do in your daily training is and at least for runners, that's very measurable. It's a little bit more tricky for cross-country skier, but you can have a treadmill running sessions gradually, and then you at least see how you respond physiologically.
Yeah.
And then as the last two things, it's kind of look at competitions and training as a learning arena. Go out there and learn something new about yourself, about your training. Make sure that you log it so you can really learn from it. I think that's, in the long run, that will make a good effect.
Yeah. And you mentioned you have worked with a lot of coaches, work with coaches, and you do research with coaches. So when you interact with coaches that have achieved great results with their athletes, and another question that I have is when you have interacted with lots of coaches, both in practice and in research settings, have you seen any common denominators in the attributes and the skills that really good coaches exhibit?
Yeah, I would say the most common thing that at least I've seen is that the process of the good coaches are very often coach-driven, but athlete-centered. It's kind of coaches who are kind of, they have good competence. They have a very clear opinion of the training philosophy. They understand the sport very well, but they focus around the athlete, so they are able to develop trust. They follow up the athletes closely, and they don't take away the autonomy and the ownership of the athlete. They actually build that. So although it's quite well coach-driven, it builds autonomy, it builds ownership in the athlete, although they have so good competence and experience that they are really able to both challenge and support the athlete on the road. So I think that's what I would highlight there.
Mm. And what is something that you have changed your mind about in training or in science in the last few years?
I'm not sure if I changed my mind, but I maybe developed my mind. I think periodization and what periodization really is, both on a macro level and a micro level. And I think for me, it's more and more about kind of having progression in the training that you have control over. And especially both on the macro, meso, and micro level is how to learn the body to gradually adapt, to make the body adaptable. So if you have changes in the training stimulus, you can, of course, decide what areas you want to develop, what areas you want to maintain, but you can also continuously help the body to be adaptable. I think that's the biggest problem among many athletes, that you just kind of, you don't adapt anymore. It's kind of, you lose your adaptability. So I think always having body adaptable to training is really important. And I think using periodization as a tool for that, and also the micro dosing of training in the training puzzle, I think that's a key there.
That's really interesting. So when you talk about periodization, you talk about progression. Is the progression here the key, you think, or is it the changing of training stimulus what do you think is the key of making sure that you keep adapting to the training?
I think both. I think you need to provide new stimulus to the body. And then you also need to have kind of an offloading and unloading. So it's kind of, you need to be aware of what stimuli you provide, what you want to develop, and what you want to maintain. I think being aware of that is important. And then you might shift that throughout the training year. So when you kind of got into saturation on one factor, you kind of change focus gradually a bit so that you can get new stimulus that is continuing the development. I think that makes something with your mind as well, because you feel that you develop in the area that you are shifting. And then I think also kind of having a little bit offloading and then increase again in stimulus, it makes kind of the body be more adaptable, and you have more control, because if you accumulate too much training over too long time without having control that you actually get kind of an effect of it, it might be that when you then start your tapering or you offload, then it kind of falls together because it wasn't an optimal balance of load and recovery. It was just that you survived, if you know what I said. I see too many athletes who they survived their preparation training, but when they then should get in good shape of it, then they just fall together because they didn't along the way have the small offloading of training to actually see how the body responded. Then you can't really control the training process. So I think that's a factor that I've been more and more aware of, at least. Then, yeah, of course, tapering, as I talked about earlier, where I think how you adapt to the situation, which is really important. And that's pretty much the same, because you then load the body, focus on a different capacity. You see that if you increase this a little bit when approaching the competitions, then you might take out the last effect. Then you need to offload sufficiently and then mobilize towards the competition. So it has also something to do with periodization. So tapering and periodization is kind of brothers and sisters.
And finally, let's go into the rapid fire questions. So take just one sentence to answer these. And the first one is, what is your favorite book or resource related to endurance sports?
Well, you know, I read a lot. So, but if I will lift up Endure by Michael Hutchinson.
Alex Hutchinson.
Alex Hutchinson, sorry. So I think that's, that was a nice, there was some provocative inputs there, some new theories. and it made me think. So that was a good one. I like being challenged.
Yeah, past guest of the show, so I will link to that episode in the show notes as well. And it is the most voted best book, best resource from everybody that has been on this podcast. And what's an important habit that you have benefited from athletically, professionally, or personally?
I would say my training diary. I think that's something we use systematically in Norway. It's kind of having control over the training and use the training diary as a learning tool. So you can actually, you don't do it to please the coach, but to learn. And I started to use that when I worked at work as well. So I have my work diary as a learning tool, which is both a planning tool and a learning tool. That has helped me a lot in my professional work. So using the same methods as we as athletes and coaches do in the working process, it's kind of been, I work in exactly the same as athletes do in my job.
Yeah, that is really good. And finally, who is somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
When I was a kid, and I think Bjørn Dæhlie was the hero of Norwegian cross-country skiing. So, and he also wrote the book about his training and how he lived and how he worked. So I think I read that 10 times. So that was inspiring me a lot. So it was at least a starting point for reading and somehow trying to learn from the best ones. So I think that was a good start. And then I had my father who was joining me around on athletics and cross-country skiing, and we were learning together, and he was kind of facilitating my curiosity, I think, on this path. So I think those two can share the podium.
Yeah, I think Bjørn Dæhlie, I would love to read that book because when I was a kid, when I first started watching cross-country skiing, I think he was towards the end of his career, but still winning big races, big championships. And of course, I was supporting other athletes, some of which in the end turned out to be dopers. So it was maybe a good thing that Bjørn Dæhlie still managed to beat them. But yeah, he's somebody that from a very young age was one of the first endurance athletes that I saw that was a hero for me as well, just in terms of how good he was, even though he wasn't the one that I supported the most. But yeah, really, I'm sure that would be a really interesting book. And to finish this interview, where can people follow you and your work?
You probably find me on PubMed or ResearchGate, at least. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. We try to share research there as well. So I think, if you want to have a look into the entire research we do, it's kind of ResearchGate is a nice portal. On PubMed, you find most of it. And then we kind of post a bit on Twitter and Facebook regularly. So have a look there.
Yeah. And the training characteristics of world-class distance runners, as we said, is open access and it's available on ResearchGate. Well, I don't know if it's technically open access, but it's available on ResearchGate. So that we will link to the full article there for people to go and have a look. Thank you so much, Eivind. It was great to chat to you. Hope that we can do it again another time. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. As mentioned, you can find a link to the paper that we discussed, The Training Characteristics of World-Class Distance Runners, an integration of scientific literature and results-proven practice as open access on ResearchGate. I will link to that in the show notes. Now, before the end of today's episode, I just want to remind you that we are offering training camps during the winter in some of the best winter climates that Europe has to offer, Mallorca in Spain and the Algarve, Portugal. We are running the camp in the Algarve at the end of January, and this one is for advanced athletes only. And then Mallorca is our bigger flagship camp that is open to a wide range of abilities in Mallorca at the end of March. You can check out all the information about both of these camps on scientifictriathlon.com and email me directly if you have additional questions or want to register. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Use their free fuel and hydration planner to understand your fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs and get a specific and effective race strategy, and book a free video consultation with the team if you want to refine it further. Use the code TTS22 at checkout for 15% off your first order of fueling and hydration products. And thank you to Senate. Use the Senate swim trainer to improve your technique, power, stamina, and swim training consistency. You can try the Senate risk-free for up to 30 days and get the special Senate and TTS bundle, including the swim trainer and a number of Senate training plans and on-demand workouts on zenatetrainer.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.